And open your Bible back up to 1 Corinthians 9. Youngsters, if you want to head to the back, there's activities for you to do. There's all sorts of stuff there. If you want to stay in the main bit of the service, you're very welcome to. There's a sheet at the back if you want that might help you just follow along. It's got some headings, some things to think of as we look at this passage. Let me just say as we start, a big thank you to all those who helped out with yesterday's day with the three churches together, particularly those who helped with the kids' work or in the kitchen or doing PA. I know a lot of you worked very hard to make that run relatively seamlessly. Thank you very much for all you did. Well, as we come to 1 Corinthians 9, what determines what you do? Is it your appetites? So, you know, you get home from a long day and you think, oh, I really fancy a curry. So I'm going to order a curry. Or I really fancy a beer or a glass of wine or a whiskey. I'm going to have a beer, a glass of wine or a whiskey. I really fancy watching the football or a soap opera or whatever it is. So you watch whatever it is you want to do. What determines what you do? Is it your appetites? I want to do it, so I do it. Or is it your rights? I've got the right to do something, so why shouldn't I do it? And why would I not do it if I'm allowed to do it? Or is it some kind of combination of the two? Let me ask you a different question. You know those times when you refrain from feeding your appetites and you refrain from using your rights? What makes you do that? I know some of you do that quite frequently. It's called a diet. I'm not going to eat this. I'm not going to eat that. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do that. Some of you might have done it for Lent. You may love chocolate. You have the right to eat chocolate. You crave chocolate, but for 40 days you've decided, I'm going to forgo my rights. I'm going to ignore my appetites. What is it that leads us to do that? What are the reasons why you would not make use of your rights? You would not obey your appetites? Now, the Corinthian culture, the Corinthian city was an appetite-driven culture. If you wanted something, you went and got it. You had the right to have it. It was also a freedom-driven culture. The freer they were, the better. And if you were free to do something and had the right to do something, then their society said, you should just do it. Grab it with both hands. And just like today, the more wealthy you were, the more freedoms you had, or the more you could get away with having more rights to indulge your appetites. Paul's been showing the Corinthians throughout this book how countercultural the gospel is. How, because they've got a new identity in Jesus, because they are his people, because they're saved by grace, because the Spirit indwells them and enriches them and empowers them, they are called to live a different life. And that means part of that is knowing what rights you have, but not necessarily using them. It might mean recognizing appetites you have, but not indulging them. Think back to chapter 5. He says the church is to discipline someone who's fulfilling his desires and appetites when he shouldn't. Think of chapter 6. He writes a sentence that would have blown their minds. Why not rather be wronged? I think it's a sentence that sometimes still blows our mind, doesn't it? It's not the normal way we think. Why not rather be wronged? And in chapter 8, we saw last week, he challenges both their appetites and their rights when he says to them, don't eat food sacrificed to idols if it will cause a brother or sister to sin. You may really want it. You may hunger for that steak that's been offered at the altar, but if it's going to destroy your brother, don't eat it. You may know that you've got the right to eat it because you're free and there are no gods behind it, but don't eat it if it's going to hurt someone else. This morning, he carries on that argument. Chapters 8, 9, and 10 are all one big argument, but they're too big for us to do in one go. And here in chapter 9, we're thinking about how does our identity as believers shape the way we use our rights and control our appetites? Now, in chapter 8, he's shown us that we're to love others and love God so much that we do things for their good, even if it costs us. And here, he's going to apply that to himself. The worst leaders in the world are those who tell you to do something and don't do it, aren't they? They're the bosses that we get most annoyed with. They're the parents we get most annoyed with. Actually, they're the leaders we get most annoyed with. And Paul wants to show the Corinthians that he's not saying just do this. He's modeled it for them. Three little headings this morning. Here's the first one. It's understand your rights. And one of the questions is, in a power, prestige, prosperity, and patronage culture, some of what Paul has done would look weird to them. In a society that said, I've got the right to do it, the more rights I make use of, the more authority and power I have, the way Paul has acted has seemed a little bit baffling to them. So Paul is, let's look at verse 1. Am I not free? What's the answer? Yes, he is. Am I not an apostle? Well, yes, you are an apostle. Have I not seen our Lord Jesus Christ? Yes, he has. Are they the church, not the result of his work in Jesus? Well, yes, they are. Paul is saying to them, look, I have rights. I am an apostle. I've got a position of someone who has seen Jesus and who's called on a specific mission to take the gospel to places that's never been before. And that means Paul has authority and Paul has rights. Now, if you were a Corinthian, you'd be thinking, right, maximize that. Make people wait on you. Make people serve you. Make people pay for you. Paul wants to show them that although he hasn't used his rights, he does understand he's got them. So verses 1 to 6, he establishes his rights as an apostle. So he says, look, at verse 4, don't we have the right to food and drink? The answer is yes, they do. If Paul's working for the church, he has the right to be provided for the church. Verse 5, don't we have the right to take a believing wife along with us, as do the other apostles and the Lord's brothers and Cephas? Well, yes, they do. As those who serve the church and are serving the gospel, they've got the right, the authority to expect the church to support them. He's an apostle. He's called. He's got a special commission. He planted the church in Corinth. He has a right to be provided for by those he preaches to. He gives a second reason why he's got the right to be provided for in verse 7, and it's one from our kind of society, isn't it? Just like theirs. He says, who serves as a soldier at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard and doesn't eat its grapes? Who tends a flock and doesn't drink its milk? Well, he said, look, just in everyday life, we know that if someone works, they deserve their pay. Think of the current conflict in Iran. As we send a destroyer steaming into the area, it is right that we pay the wages of those who are going to fight for us, isn't it? You know, we don't say, well, you chose it. We're not going to pay you. You can voluntarily do that. Think of the farmer. The farmer sows his crops and deserves to get a share of the crops. He says, look, I've got the rights of an apostle, and you know just in ordinary everyday life, if someone works for something, they deserve to get paid. Thirdly, he says the other reason he's got certain rights are there in verses 8 to 13, because the law says so. He quotes Deuteronomy, do not muzzle an ox while it's treading out the grain. He said, look, if you have an ox working to crush the grain, that's how they used to mill it to make flour, you don't put the muzzle on, you let the ox eat as it does its work. That's only fair. And then he says, look, that applies to people who work in the church as well. Verse 11. And then he gives another example in verse 13. Those who served in the temple had the right to take certain bits of food that were presented at the temple. So he's saying, look, I'm an apostle, I've got rights. The world would say I just have rights because I work hard and I deserve some pay for those I work for. The Bible teaches me that I have rights. And then his fourth reason he has rights is there in verse 14. In the same way, the Lord has commanded that those who preach the gospel should receive their living from the gospel. Back in Matthew 10, when Jesus sent his disciples out on mission, he tells them not to take a bag, not to take gold or silver or extra clothing, for the worker is worth their keep. In other words, as you go and share the good news about Jesus with the world, you should expect those who trust my word to help you out by providing what you need. What's the principle Paul is getting across? Those who work and labor for the gospel and for the church have a right to be paid for what they do. That's Paul's right. Let me say it's a really important principle for churches to grasp. If someone works for the church, they should be paid. If they work full-time, they should be paid full-time. If they work part-time, they should be paid part-time. A worker is worth his keep. Think about practically that for us for a minute. Each of us as members of the church have a responsibility to ensure that happens and to pay our part of it. We can't sit there and say, those who work for the church should be paid by the church, but I'm not giving to it. Paul is saying, look, there is a biblical command to support those who work for the gospel. It's worth just asking the question, isn't it? Does what we give reflect that command? Paul is saying, look, I've got rights, and I know what my rights are. I understand what my rights are, and you understand what my rights are. Now, we ought to just apply that to ourselves for a minute. I wonder if you understand what your rights are. I think sometimes we can fall into the trap of thinking that being a Christian says, I have no rights. I'm a doormat. Everyone gets to trample all over me. If you read through Acts of the Apostles, you'll see that's clearly not the case. There are lots of times the early church talks about the things that it is allowed to do and should be allowed to do. Paul does it. There are times he stands on his rights that he's a Roman citizen, so can't be beaten in certain ways or arrested or deserves a fair trial. Being a Christian doesn't mean we have no rights anymore. It doesn't mean we are doormats. The Bible would establish that everyone has the right to be treated with dignity and as equals because we're made in the image of God. Go back to Genesis 1, 26. God makes man and woman in the image of God. Everyone has the right to be treated as made in the image of God and precious to him and equal. And that doesn't change whether we're in a lower position in a hierarchy than someone else. That's true in the church, that's true in the family, that's true in the workplace. We need to know our rights. We also need to know our rights in terms of our workplaces. Your workplace will say you've got certain rights. Being a Christian doesn't mean to say you effectively forfeit all those rights. The same as in our society. As Christians, as a church, we have rights enshrined in laws to do with free speech and freedom of religion. We need to know those rights, and there are times we need to stand on them. So I wonder, how good are you at understanding your rights? Do we fall into the trap of thinking, as Christians, we just forgo all our rights all the time? But here's the second thing Paul teaches. He teaches that they need to, just like he does, flex on their rights. Look at verse 12. Second half of verse 12, he says, but we did not use this right. On the contrary, we put up with anything rather than hinder the gospel. Isn't that interesting? Paul knows his right to be provided for, but he doesn't use it. He flexes them for the sake of the gospel. Why? Because he doesn't want to put up a barrier to them hearing the good news about Jesus. Their society was a bit different to ours. They had lots of visiting speakers who used to go from town to town to town with all kind of ideas that they made up themselves, and they would expect the people who listened to them to pay for them. And actually what they would do is you would tailor your message from town to town to make more money. Okay? So if you went to a certain town and they loved certain things, you might adjust what you're teaching and your ideas so that more people liked you, so you raked in more money. Paul doesn't want them to think that's him. And so Paul, so that they don't think that's the way he operates, wants to offer them the gospel free of charge. And so Paul doesn't use his right. And verse 15, look, he says, I've not used any of these rights. I'm not writing this in the hope that you do such things. You know what we're like, don't we? And you can imagine the Corinthians thinking, oh no, Paul had the right to money. We didn't give it. Some of them with their overactive guilt complexes would be thinking, oh no, he's asking us for money. Quick, we better write him a check and send it to him. That's not what he's saying. He makes that clear in verse 15. I'm not writing this in the hope you'll do such things for me. Paul flexes on his rights partly because verses 16 to 18, he has a unique calling. For when I preach the gospel, I cannot boast since I'm compelled to preach. Woe to me if I don't preach the gospel. If I preach voluntarily, I have a reward. If not voluntarily, I'm simply discharging the trust committed to me. What then is my reward? Just this, that in preaching the gospel, I offer it free of charge and so not make use of my full rights as a preacher of the gospel. Don't get overly confused with what Paul is saying there. He's simply saying, look, God called me in a unique way and gave me a unique job. And because of that, I feel like I need to just keep presenting the gospel for free. So think about Paul for a minute. He's saved on the road to Damascus. He's going there to kill Christians. And Jesus appears to him and confronts him with his sin and sends him into Damascus. And then Ananias comes to him and prays for him. And suddenly Paul sees the truth of the gospel. But Ananias tells him he will be God's messenger to the Gentiles. And Paul goes as a trailblazer, doesn't he? Where does he go? He always goes to places where there is no church. And so he's always preaching to people who don't know Jesus and establishing churches. And so Paul is saying, look, he has a unique mission. Now, in Timothy, he'll teach that Timothy is to be paid by the churches because Paul has set the church up. Now the church is running. He's sending them a pastor to establish them, and he should be paid. Paul is saying, I have a unique job. And so my unique joy, my unique boast is in seeing people turn to Jesus, not earning a wage from it. His job is to steward the gospel, to offer it free of charge. Now, one of the principles that we draw out of that is that actually that's what we do with missionaries, isn't it? When we send a missionary to an unreached people group to reach them, who pays the missionary? The church back home. We don't expect the villages or the town or the country they're going to. That's what Paul is saying. As a missionary to those who don't know Jesus, I didn't ask for money from you because I didn't want to confuse the issue. I just want to preach the gospel. He also flexes his rights in a different way. Look at verses 19 to 23. It's not just in terms of money that he flexes his rights. He says, though I'm free and belong to no one, I've made myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I'm not free from God's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I became weak to win the weak. I've become all things to all people, so that by all means I might save some. I wonder if you spot a phrase that you sometimes hear in our culture. I've become all things to all people. The problem is the way our society uses that is negative, isn't it? In other words, they're a chameleon, they're a hypocrite. They're one thing with one people, one thing with another. Interesting subversion of what Paul's saying, isn't it? Next time someone uses that, great opportunity to have a conversation with them. Do you know the origin of that? Do you know where it comes from? Paul is actually saying he doesn't want to do anything to put any barriers in the way of the gospel. Look what he says. He says that when he goes to the Jews, he lives like a Jew. In other words, if he goes to share the gospel with the Jews, he makes sure he follows the cleanliness laws that they would follow. If he had a Jewish family around for a meal, he wouldn't serve pork and bat because they're unclean for them. He doesn't want to put up any barriers to them hearing the gospel. Paul's not being a hypocrite. He's being culturally sensitive. The same with when he's with the Jews, those who don't have the law. He has a freedom to not follow the law because that would put up barriers. He doesn't insist that they have to live like the Jews do. But neither does he engage in everything they do. So look at a little bit in brackets in verse 21. Though I'm not free from God's law, but I'm under Christ. In other words, when I'm with the Gentiles, I live like the Gentiles, but I don't engage in some of their sin. So take Corinth. It was famous for immorality and idolatry. I don't do those things to reach the lost. It's interesting, isn't it? Thinking about the way we do evangelism. We want to be all things to all people, but without engaging in sin. We want to flex what we do and don't do so that we can help people see who Jesus is. And then verse 23, he takes them back to chapter 8 and the issue of those in the church who've got weak consciences. To the weak, I became weak to win the weak. He's done what he's calling the Corinthians to do, flex their rights and freedoms when it would stop someone else hearing the gospel. His goal in the flexing is to share the gospel so people come to faith. Do you see what Paul's teaching the Corinthians, what he's teaching us? Know your freedoms and rights, but know that you can flex on them for the gospel. Don't insist on your rights if it puts up a barrier to someone else coming to faith or growing in their faith. Now, where does that get traction for us? I've scratched my head a bit with this week. Let me give you a couple. I've got a Muslim family who live next door. Absolutely lovely. They make amazing curries and bring us some every so often. And they are just delightful and helpful. Now, I'm always really careful with my Muslim neighbor about where I put the Bibles in my house. I would never put my Bible on the floor. Because if they came round and saw my Bible on the floor, it says to them, as a Christian, I don't care about God's word. Because they always keep the Quran off the floor, and in fact, it's elevated and kept in a place because it's special. If I ever want my Muslim neighbors to hear the gospel and respond, having my Bible on the floor is an unnecessary barrier. Do I have the right to put my Bible on the floor? Yeah, I can. Do I flex my right and my freedom? I ought to. I wonder where that works out for you. I wonder where you have those that you know of, friends, family, colleagues. What are the things where you can flex on a freedom in a way to not put a barrier up to the gospel? What about for us as a church? I think one of our things as a church is in not having jargon language we use. Trying to keep things simple and straightforward and explain what they are. So what Paul is saying, know your rights and your freedoms, but flex your rights and your freedoms. Here's the last thing, verses 24 to the end of the chapter. This is a little bit of a bridge between chapter 9 and chapter 10. Now in chapter 8, he taught them that don't eat certain foods if it will destroy your brother because you love your brother and sister. In chapter 10, he's going to teach them, don't go to the idol celebrations and celebrate with them, because although gods aren't behind it, actually there is demonic activity behind it. And here he's drawing a link with them. I wonder if you watch the Olympics or the athletics. It's about to be the World Indoor Championships. And you will see lots of people. But you know they don't just turn up and run, right? They don't just decide one morning, oh, I'm going to do the 800 meters and do it in a world record time. They have spent years dedicating themselves, training every day, and being careful what they eat. Now, Corinth was the home of a set of games. It was the Isthmian Games. Every 2 years, people came from all around, and they had big athletic competitions. And Paul uses that image in verse 24. He gives them a picture of a race, and pictures runners running. His point is not that only one person's going to win. Okay, don't take that away. It's not that the church is to compete. His point is there at the end of verse 24. Run in such a way as to get the prize. What's he saying? As a Christian, what is the prize that we have in mind? It is a reward of being welcomed by Jesus and into a new creation home and being given a crown to wear as one of his people. That's the image Paul uses. And he takes the image of the games, and he takes the image of a temporary crown that they used to get, a kind of laurel wreath that they would get that would wither and die within 6 months, but says that you're running for an eternal crown. So what does he say there to do? Well, look at verse 25. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. Do you remember Usain Bolt, world's fastest man? I remember hearing him interviewed after one Olympics, and he asked, what was he looking forward to most? And he said, McDonald's. Because unusually for him, he'd not had any McDonald's in the 6 months before that. And he wanted a McDonald's. I remember hearing an interview with some footballers who were saying, what's the thing they love most after a game? It's that on the bus on the way back, they stop off and get pizza on the way home because they've not had it for the week before. Oddly enough, they never won anything. Strict training is necessary. An athlete doesn't eat whatever they want or indulge their appetites. They train right. He's saying, look, for Christians, we're not to indulge all of our appetites because they can damage us. Secondly, look, he says, know what you're aiming at. Therefore, verse 26, I don't run like someone running aimlessly. A runner knows where they've got to go. They know the finish line. That's true of a 100-meter runner, isn't it? Have you noticed? You watch the 100 meters. As they run, what are they doing? they stare straight ahead at the finish line. They're not running looking side to side, because if they did that, you know, they would end up wandering off all over the place. I mean, some of you struggle to walk straight if you're not looking the way you're going. Imagine doing that at speed. So look, focus your eyes and know where you're going. Don't get distracted by everything around you. Don't meander. Don't be aimless. Have a target. Fix your eyes on the prize of Jesus' return and run. And then he talks about, I don't fight like a boxer beating the air. It's an interesting image, isn't it? Do you know, if you want to have a 100% record of knockouts, shadow box. Okay? But actually, it's pointless. Have you ever unwittingly walked in on someone who's kind of shadow boxing? It's quite entertaining. But actually, it's pointless because there's no real enemy. What's he saying? So he's saying, look, as Christians, we have a real enemy. Don't shadow box. Fight the real enemy. In Corinth, who wants to get into the church and divide it and cause them to destroy each other by what they eat. And then look at the last thing he says, verse 27. No, I strike a blow to my body and make it my slave, so that after I've preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified from the prize. He says, look, I'm fighting an enemy out there, but I'm fighting it by controlling my body. Okay, his image there is not actually inflicting pain on yourself. His image there is controlling his body, stopping it living by appetites that will destroy himself or destroy others. That's quite a challenging little section, isn't it? He's saying to the Corinthians, it is possible to start the race well and wander off the track and be disqualified. It's possible to start the fight well but lose sight of what you're fighting for and who your enemy is. It's possible to start the fight well but not train for it and so end up lost. He's going to carry that on when we come back to 1 Corinthians after Easter. What's one of the things he's showing them is that the Israelites did exactly that. They started off well and then wandered off into immorality and idolatry and ended up lost. Don't do that, he says. It's a little section that challenges us, isn't it? Do we know our rights? Do we flex on our rights? Are we running the race? Are we controlling our appetites? Are we flexing on our freedoms? Do we know that we're trying to get everyone in our church family to the same goal of knowing Jesus and reaching home? And is all of our effort being given to that end?